Hello and welcome to the Symantec Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today are Symantec threat researchers Bridget O'Gorman and Candid West. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about the espionage group known as the Inception Framework and some new malware they've been using. We'll also be taking a look at how small and medium-sized businesses are struggling to cope with cyber attacks, a new vulnerability in building automation software, and just how much money the Gand Crab ransomware group are making.
But first, we published a new piece of research today about the Lazarus Group, whose latest wave of attacks involves stealing cash from ATMs. Dick has actually been involved in this research, so maybe you can tell us more about it. First of all, maybe give us a bit of background on who Lazarus are.
Yes, so Lazarus are a very large group who have been involved in both espionage and cybercrime. They were initially known for their involvement in a series of espionage attacks, but they really came to public attention a number of years ago for a series of high-profile disruptive attacks, including the 2014 attack on Sony Pictures, which saw lots of information being stolen from the company, including film scripts and also lots of their computers wiped by malware. So very aggressive attack. But rather unusually for a group involved in espionage, Lazarus has also become involved in financially motivated attacks. The group was linked to the $81 million theft from the Bangladesh Central Bank in 2016, along with a number of smaller bank heists. And then Lazarus was also linked to the WannaCry ransomware outbreak in 2017. And as we all remember, within hours of its release, they'd infected hundreds of thousands of computers worldwide. After the Sony Pictures attack, the FBI came out and said that the attackers were linked to the North Korean government. And since then, the US government has consistently said that Lazarus is linked to the North Korean government.
Okay, so they were some pretty high-profile attacks, but their latest activity involves attacks on ATMs.
Yes. The background to all of this is that around a month ago, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the Treasury Department all put out a joint alert via US CERT about a Lazarus operation that they call Fast Cash. So what is Fast Cash? It's basically a fraud operation designed to steal cash from ATMs. How does it work? The Lazarus Group compromises switch application servers run by the operators of ATM networks, which will usually be banks. And getting onto those servers means that they can intercept fraudulent withdrawal requests, block them from going any further into the transaction processing system, and then they will also send back fraudulent withdrawal approval responses to the ATM. So very simply, it allows them to get ATMs to spit out cash for them.
Okay, and how much has been stolen in these attacks then?
Well, according to the US government's report, they've stolen tens of millions of dollars using Fast Cash. And for now, they've concentrated on banks in Africa and Asia. And there hasn't been any evidence of attacks elsewhere, like in the US. They cited one incident in 2017 where cash was simultaneously withdrawn from ATMs located in over 30 countries. And then in another incident in 2018, they simultaneously stole cash from ATMs in 23 different countries. So that kind of gives you a picture of the scale of this operation.
Yeah, so pretty vast. And can you explain to us then what we uncovered in our own research into this?
Yeah, what we've published today essentially builds on that US government report from last month and adds some new information about the Fast Cash operation. Some of our analysts here have uncovered the malware that's being used to perform these attacks, and not surprisingly, we've christened it Trojan.FastCash. So all of the banking application servers running, all of the banking application servers attacked run unsupported versions of IBM's AIX operating system beyond the end of their service pack support dates. Trojan.FastCash is a malicious AIX executable, which is injected into a running legitimate process on the switch application server. And the Trojan contains logic that allows it to construct fraudulent ISO 8583 messages, ISO 853 being the standard for financial transaction messaging. So once it's up and running, the Trojan will read all the incoming network traffic to the server, scanning for incoming 8583 request messages. It will read the primary account number on all of those messages. And if it finds any containing a PAN number used by the attackers, it'll block that message from going any further. And then it will transmit back a fake response message approving the fraudulent withdrawal request. So the net result is that the attempt to withdraw money via an ATM by the Lazarus attackers will be approved.
Okay, wow. So it sounds like it's quite a specialized piece of malware then.
It really is, yeah. And it demonstrates that they know their way around banking and payment systems and have the knowledge then to create tools to mount fraud operations against them. And it's a common theme we've seen with Lazarus. Earlier attacks like the Bangladesh bank heist also required a lot of in-depth knowledge about how banking, payment and messaging systems work. And it goes to show that these financially motivated attacks aren't just a passing interest for Lazarus, but they're now really a core component of the group's activities.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, so I think that's enough about Lazarus because we've actually got plenty more to talk about today. The next thing we wanted to discuss was some news that broke this week about the Inception Framework Group, who are using a tool called PowerShower. And this isn't about bathroom fittings. The Inception Framework is an espionage group, have been active since 2014, and we ourselves have published on its activity before. So Candid, can you tell us what they've been up to now?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as you said, we've reported on the Inception Framework Group before, and of course also highlighted their usage of IoT proxies and cloud services. But this week, the Unit 42 team have published their details on a new case. And as you said, they dubbed the whole malware PowerShower, as it's based on a PowerShell script that also scrubs off all the forensic traces afterwards. So it does kind of make sense. And the attack group is known to use spear phishing emails, with usually using the trick of remote templates from Word documents. So this is a feature of Microsoft Word, which allows you or any local document to load a template file once it is opened. And of course, this resource can also be stored externally. And this obviously brings some huge benefits to the attackers, as the initial document from the spear phishing email is not malicious per se, right? It just contains a reference to a remote template, which could be legitimate, could be benign, or in that case, is malicious. So this initial spear phishing document might pass through some filtering service unnoticed. And the server hosting the remote template can then analyze their request and decide which payload they want to send them, or of course also decide not to send the payload at all if, for example, the IP address does not match any certain profile. So this makes it quite flexible and targeted for the attackers, and on the other hand, making it harder for the analysts to actually make a proper analysis on the file. And this is also a very good example of the increased targeted focus, or if you want to call it, reconnaissance that we've seen used in targeted attacks. As very often, the attackers will actually analyze some details about the environment, like kind of a fingerprinting of the systems, and then dynamically decide what payload they will deliver, and only infect the machines which are of any potential value to them. So we've seen that many times in the past, and of course there have been cases where the malware will only decrypt if decrypt itself if it's on a computer with a specific username or even just an IP address.
Yes, I remember we saw the same thing in the Flame malware, didn't we? So the attackers fingerprint the compromised computer to learn what they are and decide what they want to do with it.
Yeah, exactly. Flame was a good example where they used a specific username to decrypt the payload, and only on that machine they would actually get active for the next stage. So in the case of the Inception framework, they sent back a document with a memory corruption vulnerability from 2017, but there's been also a few cases where they used older Office vulnerabilities, even one from 2012. So make sure you always patch, of course. If this exploit was successful, then the payload will be executing a Visual Basic script, which in turn contains an obfuscated PowerShell script, which is then the first stage of malware. So this backdoor is very simple, but nevertheless, of course, effective, as it's deleting any traces of the infection, such as temporary files, registry keys created, and so on. So classical cleanup job, which makes, of course, the forensic analysis a lot more difficult. The backdoor also makes sure that any future PowerShell invocation will actually be hidden by setting some registry keys to move the default window off the screen. So it makes it a lot harder to actually see that something's going on. And of course, furthermore, it collects additional fingerprinting information from the computer, sends it off to the command and control server, and then, last but not least, checks for additional payloads to be downloaded. And those payload modules, if any of those are found, will then be downloaded and executed. They could be Visual Basic scripts, could be PowerShell scripts. And of course, even once those are executed, they will also be cleaned up, so any traces will be removed. In the past, we've seen that some of the modules are stuff like stealing documents or any other files. There's been a module for browser where they steal bookmarks and any stored credentials. So anything that could be of interest to the attackers.
Okay, and it's fair to point out at this stage that we at Symantec have various protection mechanisms in place to protect our customers from these kinds of attacks. So let's move on, because we spend a lot of time on the podcast talking about attacks against big organizations, but it's worth bearing in mind that they aren't the only ones at risk. Isn't that right, Bridget?
Yeah, so small and medium-sized businesses often maybe don't realize that they too are at a big risk from cyber criminals. And maybe they won't realize this until it's too late and then they become victims of a cyber attack. An insurance firm, Hiscox, has released a report called the Small Business Cyber Risk Report. And it reveals that almost half of the small businesses it surveyed, it surveyed about 4,000 businesses based in countries including the US, UK and Europe, had suffered at least one cyber attack in the previous 12 months, with 44% of them suffering between 2 and 4 attacks. When it comes to the type of attacks, ransomware attacks were the most common type of attacks suffered by these small businesses, perhaps unsurprisingly, while the loss or misuse of data was also another big issue that was faced by these companies, according to this report. Of course, when it comes to data loss and misuse, the culprit's often not an external attacker, but rather perhaps a careless or an uninformed employee. So the fact that this is a problem for small businesses underlines the fact that small businesses too do need to have a clear policy in place when it comes to things like cybersecurity and the protection of, you know, people's privacy and company data. However, this survey found that only 52% of the companies surveyed, so just over half, actually had a clearly defined strategy around the cybersecurity area.
Right, yeah, that isn't an overly inspiring percentage, is it? What other findings were in the survey?
Yeah, no, it isn't a great percentage. And it's a bit contradictory, too, in ways, because those surveys did say that cyber attacks were one of their top concerns for their business. However, half of them also said that a lack of budget was a major challenge when it comes to addressing cybersecurity risks. But not investing in this area, you know, could prove to be really a false economy for businesses. As small businesses in the US estimated that their average cost for addressing cybersecurity incidents in the last year was almost $35,000, which for a small business is a significant amount of money. Say for large companies, this cost went up to around $1 million. And while 2/3 of the small companies surveyed said they were concerned or extremely concerned about the cyber risk they faced, less than 1/4 of them have a leadership role in the business that is actually dedicated to cybersecurity. So it seems that there is a disconnect there really between the fact that the companies are concerned, but then the measures they have in place to ensure their company has actually minimized its risk of being a victim of cybercrime. And I mean, this is important as we have seen the huge impact being a victim of cybercrime has on businesses. I mean, be it on their bottom line as they face, you know, take on the cost of any losses, as well as the cost of recovering from the attack, or often more importantly, the damage that being a victim of a cyber attack or a data breach can do to the reputation of their business. And considering that, you know, small businesses, they often operate on very tight margins, you know, the cost of recovering from a cyber attack could really prove to be pretty crippling for them.
Yeah, I mean, $35,000, as you say, is a massive sum for small businesses.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot you can do with much less to protect your company. So, as you say, it's probably a kind of false economy by skimping on it. So, do we have any tips to help small businesses enhance their cybersecurity?
Yeah, well, obviously we advise that they invest in, you know, good intrusion prevention and antivirus technologies like what we supply here at Symantec in order to keep their businesses safe. And it's also advisable for businesses to ensure that staff at all levels of the business are educated about the cyber threats the company, you know, can face. Things like phishing and, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, all employees need to be aware of those kind of threats. And it's also important that there's someone in the business who, you know, takes the lead when it comes to cybersecurity and ensures that policies in that area are implemented throughout the business. And cybersecurity should also be, you know, included when it comes to things like budget, and space should be made for it. As we said, a failure to invest in that protection and education, you know, could lead to much bigger costs for these businesses in the long run.
Okay. All right. Now, let's go back to you, Candid, because the ICS cert warned about a vulnerability in building management software. Does this mean that attackers can soon shut down the lights and the heating in my building?
Well, to be fair, there have already been quite a few cases and attacks against building automation systems. So, yes, there is a chance that someone will turn off the lights if your building uses such technology, right? But I don't want to cry wolf here because, of course, the cases are still quite limited. But there are many building management software and device integration solutions out there. These can then be used to control heating, cooling, ventilations, lift, access control, fire alarms, power, and so on. So for a lot of things inside of larger buildings, specifically office buildings, of course. And in this newest case, the Industrial Controls System CERT warned about the vulnerability in the building automation software from Sauter Controls. And some research from Applied Risk found an XML external entity flaw, which can, of course, be executed and exploited remotely by any attacker. So this basically means that you can embed a link to a resource inside an XML file or XML entity, and the XML parser will then fetch the data for you. Hence, a attacker could use this to steal any file from the affected system. And we all know any of those disclosed files could then contain credentials or configuration settings, which in turn could lead to further attacks in the future. The vulnerability itself has been rated critical with a CVSS score of 7.5, so quite high. But we are not aware of any cases where this has been exploited in the wild yet. So that's the good part. But of course, as always, people should update to the newest patched version, which is available for this control software, and also make sure that they limit network access to these interfaces as good as possible. As I think one thing is definitely clear, right? We see building automation is increasingly being used and installed, and therefore could definitely become an interesting target for attackers in the future.
Yeah, I mean, as our homes and our buildings get smarter and smarter, and the more systems are being used to control them, the more potential avenues for attack are there, and the more important it becomes to secure all of these systems. Okay. Finally, we discussed the attackers behind the GanCrab ransomware on the show 2 weeks ago. And after they released the decryption key for all of the ransomware Syrian victims. But they've been in the news yet again this week. Bridget, can you tell me more about this?
Yeah, so the group was in again, or excuse me, the group was in the news this week for a different reason. Because Bitdefender had done some research into the group and its profitability. And it estimates that the attackers behind GanCrab have netted payouts totaling in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, it estimates that the group has made as much as $250 million in the last few months through victims paying its ransom demands. So maybe that explains why, you know, they were happy enough to let the Syrian victims off the hook.
Well, that's an incredible amount of money.
Yeah, it's really a huge amount of money. And unlike a lot of other ransomware operators who can sometimes be, you know, quite on-targeted, they just kind of try and infect as many machines as possible. GandCrab is known for demanding, you know, exorbitant ransoms and often creating personalized ransomware notes if they realize that they've infected high-value devices that belong to wealthy companies. So they're, you know, the targets that they really want to hit are large corporations that would pay out large payouts. And I mean, the thing is, these companies, if they have the money, they may be willing to pay like a really big ransom to make a problem simply go away and to get their data back. And the lowest ransomware note reportedly received from the GandCrab attackers was $600, which is quite high by, you know, ransomware standards. Some ransoms are, you know, quite small. With their ransomware demands reportedly soaring as high as $700,000, which is just like an eye-watering figure. And I suppose while it's understandable that businesses hit by this kind of ransomware and by ransomware in general just want their data back, we obviously don't advise the victims give in to these ransom demands, as it just encourages, you know, the cyber criminals to continue carrying out these kind of attacks. And of course, as well as that, you know, you are dealing with criminals, so even if you pay a ransom, you don't really have a guarantee that you will get your data back. So really the best way to kind of protect yourself from, you know, people like the GandCrab attackers and other ransomware criminals is to regularly back up, you know, your important data and your systems so that anything critical can be recovered in the event of a ransomware attack without you having to pay the ransom and give in to these attackers. Actually, for GandCrab as well, it's kind of more notable that they've made so much money in recent times because there is a decryption key available for some versions of this ransomware, and it's been available since February. So if there are any victims of GandCrab out there, they should look into that as well.
Okay, some useful info there. Thank you, Bridget. That is all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying the podcast, please subscribe to avoid missing out on any future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at ThreatIntel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, including the new research on Fastcache we were discussing earlier, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week when we'll be once again looking at what's going on in the world of cybersecurity. Until then, thank you and goodbye.